Okay, today I'm at Ludlow with, I suppose we'd call you a journeyman bookmaker, Barry. Barry Pinnow Pennington. Bets from Perth to Exeter and all sorts of weird and wonderful places in between, unless I'm greatly mistaken. Thanks for agreeing to do this, Barry. Can you start from the beginning, your first interest, recollection of bookmaking or on-course gambling or whatever?
Yeah, I suppose I learned the habit of bookmaking and betting and gambling from my father. He was originally a grounds owner up in Chester, where we lived at the time, and used to run a lot of grounds at Chester Ground Track and local local tracks in the northwest, flapping tracks predominantly. I probably started going to Chester races round about when I was from the age of 10. Used to do the floor, run the line for him, give him the prices. My mum, God bless her, would do the clerking, the old booking tickets. And I would learn the trade from a very, very young basic age, to be honest with you. From the craft of running down to the line on the photographs, because in them days we used to bet on a short head, a dead heat, a head, half a length, etc., etc. And they used to be quite popular with punters. So, of course, trying to get an edge over the punters is obviously paramount, being a bookmaker or a bookmaker's runner or doing the floor for my dad. So, hence, I used to initially ply my trade, looking across the line, albeit 10 or 11, getting a couple of the old stools, the old boxes, standing on the boxes, looking across at the line, which at Chester, the grounds, was two sides. You had a cheap ring, which where my dad stood, and you'd have a deer side, where obviously the likes of old man Mr. Corbett and all the big bookies, inverted commas, would stand. So we'd look directly across to the winning line, find out, hopefully, what I'd won, work out what I'd won. There'd be half a dozen of us legging it back then to the bookies, learning the tic-tac. My dad taught me tic-tac at an early age, but he always had to have a twist, my dad. And at Chester Dogs, it was always whatever had won had come second. So, of course, he'd have a twist card, he'd look down at his card, number one. I'd be saying, Dad, it's number three. In fact, he'd look down, it's number one. Here we go, everybody. They'd all dive in, thinking, watching me, thinking I'd given the right results. And, of course, he'd cream a bit off the top. So that was my first recollection, Simon, of bookmaking and the craft, if you like, and know-how of doing the floor. And that was my first introduction, really.
So do you remember the first day you came out betting under your own steam with your own money?
Well, initially, it used to be dead man's shoes. So my father, he'd actually gone from poacher to gamekeeper, used to have grounds, did his money, and then decided to go betting, bookmaking. And so hence, I think in the 70s, late 70s, he put his name down on all the Northwest lists. And it used to be, they called it dead man's shoes, because basically you might have 100 names on the list for each different individual ring, tats, silver ring, chest eight. Of course, you've got the course or the goat yard. Put your name down as many lists as you can, cost you a pound. And then you'd either just turn up on the day and hope there's pitches available, which in general, most places there were, although obviously on good days, he wouldn't get on off a really high number, solely because obviously a good day, you know, the money's around, all the bookmakers with a good position would turn up. So it was more so we would turn up, I would turn up with my dad, clerking, the old booking tickets, like I say, to some of the poorer meetings. So, and he would have poor pitches. So I suppose, when it comes down to learning the craft, it's not like he was thrown into the deep end in good pitches. It was basically being thrown into the deep end with poor pitches. So you would have to learn quite quickly, you know, otherwise you wouldn't last for the next week, because solely because you're betting poorly in a poor position. Even in those days when the figures were good, in a poor position you still bet poorly. So hence, I used to go along and I would clerk for him, and obviously pick up on everything that's sort of going on with regards to, you know, the tic-tacking, the floor, better prices over there, when you lay off, when to lay a favourite maybe, you know, the highs and lows of doing things properly or making quite a few ricks. I worked for my dad for quite a long time. One of the first instances where I moved away to Devon and lived down in Devon for a few years after my mother died, one of the first instances, which I thought was quite funny looking back on it, but my dad didn't at the time, he was short of a clerk, for Cheltenham, and he had a Cheltenham pitch in the Silvering, in the Best Mate. Poor pitch, but in those days, we're looking at probably 30 years ago, the ring was like very, very good in Cheltenham in general. And bookmaking in those days was very good, even off poor pitches, which is more we could say before sort of now, nowadays. So of course, he rings me up. I'm living in Devon. I've got a full-time job, not seen much of him. Barry, I need a clerk. I said, look, Dad, I'm sorry, I can't really work. You know, I've got other work on. I need a clerk, booking tickets. You know, can you come, son? Well, I can't read that. I'll make it worth your while. I'll put you a quarter in the book. Oh, right, okay, then I'm thinking that might be more to my liking. So, yeah, all right then. Okay, you twisted my arm. Anyway, cut a long story short, we go to Cheltenham, we actually win 10 grand. We win £10,000 over 4 days that week. Unbelievable results. My dad did everything right, which was quite unusual at times. Did everything right, and of course, I'm clocking up. Aye, I'm in for a quarter here, boys and girls. And I've never seen somebody sort of so broken-hearted as when my dad had to, even though it's his own offspring, his own son, and everything else, had to hand over £2,500 to me, which would normally cost him maybe £200 or £300 just to pay the clerk, and he'd get the rest of the bunts. So basically, he gave me £2,500 out of his own pocket, inverted commas, even though I was like different class on the book, I might have you add. So that was one of my first recollections. And after that, he never put me in the book again. So, of course, I then thought, right, I quite fancy doing a bit of this myself. Obviously, when you're earning that sort of money, a month's wage in 4 days, then, you know, the bottom line is, I'd like to maybe try this myself. So then I looked into it all, got my license, but instead of applying to the, it was the BPA then, instead of applying to the BPA, I thought, right, I'll rep for my dad. And my dad had quite a lot of poorish pitches, but he doubled up quite often in certain places, point to points, or, silvering the likes of Ludlow, where we are today. A poorish ring, with all due respect to Ludlow at the time, a poorish ring, but at least I could go out and work and learn my trade, if you like, and apply my trade. And that's what I did. So, late 80s, early 90s, I would just go out weekends and work in the pitches that my dad didn't want to work in, and trade under his name, which is Stute. He traded as Stute a lot of the northern tracks. So that's how, roughly, I got into sort of bookmaking on my own steam, off my own back.
So now, correct me if I'm wrong, you bet in Scotland and you bet in Devon. So how did you go about amassing and how did you manage such a big portfolio of pitches?
Well, to be honest, Simon, in 1998, I think it was, and I think it was probably after going to the Derby a few times, which was quite lucrative. You know, stand up on the hill, you could plonk your joint anywhere. They would come along and just check your licence, and really, you might not all know about John Batten, but John Batten was the guy who probably not even John Batten, but set up the name John Batten, put his tripod and joint up on in the middle of the hill on the Derby, forged a gambling licence, or not gambling licence, but a licence, which we all had to show on the day, stood. Went bigger prices, God knows what it's like to the bookies standing next to him in the line, thinking, who's this idiot come along? Another one who hasn't got a clue. But little did they know, he was going to do a runner halfway through the Derby. You know, he was apparently he was training to do the 100 metre sprint beforehand. So all he did was push the prices out, get as much as he could in, fill his heart, and then leg it. And his name was John Batten, or his alias was John Batten. So after that, I think the regulations became a lot tighter, a lot of things were tightened up, and hence we then, the AGT, the BPA then, sort of probably were told to tighten everything up, and that's when buying and selling came in. So buying and selling, so it wasn't in the rings, it wasn't dead man's shoes, where obviously as somebody dies, the whole list moves up. It might take you 40 years to get into Cheltenham Tats at the time, or Ascot Tats. So buying and selling came in, and that predominantly changed the whole scenario for me as a part-time weekend rep for my dad. It meant that I could ply my trade on racecourses under my own steam, under my own name. So that's when the buying and selling first came in, and the early auctions came in, whereby all the old guys could sell the pitches. Obviously, instead of maybe retiring in the past and losing the pitch and everybody else move up, now they could sell the pitches and they could obviously get a few bob, depending on what number it was, how many they had, etc., etc. So there was a lot. There was a big change in the rings then, and instead of then waiting to get onto a race course, you could actually buy number one, number two, whatever became available if you had the funds, if you had the, you know, the inclination, or if you fancied going into certain race tracks, you know, your dream could come true. So it brought a lot of fresh blood into the ring. And so I looked at this and I thought, yeah, okay. I didn't have a lot of money, to be fair. I was a working man through the week. So I thought, right, okay, I quite fancy this. So I decided to buy, the answer to your question, Simon, is cheap pitches, which I think looking back on was probably not the right thing to do. But I thought, right, I'm going to make this a career whereby I want to go out, 7 days a week, if possible, 7 days a week. So I thought, right, I'm going to buy as many cheapish pitches as I could at lots of different race courses. And they were quite cheap. However, looking back at it now, some I paid, for argument's sake, Utoxeter, I'm number 34. Now, I like going to Utoxeter. That pitch is probably now worth maybe £2,000 if I'm lucky. I paid in the region of £6,500 for, whereby if I'd have bought a pitch at Ascot, Royal Ascot, say a similar sort of number 33, I probably could have bought it for maybe £4,000 or £5,000, and it's now worth £25,000. So I didn't buy particularly well, but however, I wanted it to be a career, and I wanted to go out on a daily basis, which is what I've done to this day. So hence, from Perth to Exeter, or Newton Abbot until I sold a couple of years ago, answering your question, all down the west coast generally, just to get a day's work. So I'd go to Hexham, and then right, okay, I can now go on to Ayr, or I can go on to and stay away. And my wife and I used to do a lot of travelling together, and it's not only travelling, it's also enjoying, going to new towns, new places, game of golf up in Scotland, or go and see relatives in Devon, go and stay in Torquay, have two or three nights in Torquay, do Exeter, do Newton Abbot, do Taunton, albeit poor pitches, but still having the confidence to sort of feel as if I can make it pay out of all pitches, because, I mean, you can make it pay, most bookmakers make it pay, otherwise they go by the wayside, but everyone has their own way of doing things, whether they bet without the favourite, without two favourites, bet on the aways, depending where your pitch is, how busy it is, what ring you go into. There's a lot of anomalies having a lot of different pitches, albeit cheaper ones.
So what is your strategy? Do you study and bet to an opinion?
I bet to an opinion, Simon, yeah. More so, to be quite honest with you, over jumps, because I feel with jumps, I have a better chance, solely because I'd be like, okay, today's not a great example where you've got a 1-10 and a 1-4 in the first two races. But you can generally, as a bookmaker, get the short ones in at the right price. So 6-4, opposed to go to Chester and it'll be 3 or 4-1 the field. Now, if I want to stand a favourite and stand it for X amount, let's say £500, I can lay a 600 for four, I've got £400 in my bag. If it's a 3 or 4-1 poke, I've got £150 in my bag. Hence I need to put I need to probably lay a few more of the short ones, whereby if I study the form and the ground goes soft or heavy or changes, and there's a short one that I can look through and think, well, that's probably not going to quite go on the ground. I know if I stand it and it gets beat, I can get a reasonable amount of money in my back pocket. It doesn't always stand like that, but I do a reasonable amount of form, yes.
Okay, and you were mentioned recently in dispatches by professional punter Neil Channing on Luck on Sunday. You're going to duck him if he turns up at your pitch?
Well, I mean, no, I've never ducked anyone, to be quite honest with you. I've never ducked anyone. I try and oblige people, even in this day and age where we live in a world of light boards. So people, it can change on the exchanges. And as you know, Simon, we're all slaves to the exchanges these days, which I hate, really, to be quite honest with you. But we, unfortunately, when we're on course now, we don't have too much choice about going over the odds on Betfair, going under the odds, then other people will be higher than you, up to the bone. So when you get, professional players like Neil coming in, although they don't come into the ring very often now since the advent of exchanges, because in general, they can get their money on the exchanges within reason, although some markets can be quite weak. They've been trading for 24 hours, prices for 24 hours. In the old days, of course, it used to be the old tissue price would turn up, it'd be 20 minutes before the off, or we're not quite sure what price is going to be what until then. Whereas now, the exchanges have been trading for 24 hours, the price on course towards the off, even quarter of an hour to the off, is basically not far off what that horse price should be.
Okay, Barry, as if the all the pictures you've got on racecourses aren't enough to keep you busy, I understand you go to a lot of rather unconventional places where you can take a bet. Can you talk us through some of those, please?
Well, I go to unconventional places, yeah, although they are regulated, I have to say. You know, they all come under, I do a lot of harness racing, and that comes under the BHRC, the British Harness Racing Club. Well regulated throughout the UK, England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland, Northern Ireland, and obviously the Republic of Ireland. I do a lot of trotting. The reason I got into trotting was, again, going back to my father and repping. When my dad didn't have spare pictures available off the old ESL lists, off the old numbers, where I couldn't go to a racecourse a weekend, I got chatting to a few people, and a few of my fellow bookies or punters turned around and said, oh, I'm off trotting. Looked into it, trotting stroke harness racing. I looked into it and I thought, yeah, I quite fancy that. Because being, if you like, conventional, with regards to being brought up on the dogs, the greyhound racing, yeah, booking tickets, doing your own prices, yeah, nobody tells you the prices, pricing up yourself. Yeah, so pricing up basically off your own accord, which I like, you know, and that's the joy of, if you like, trots, points, dog racing. There's no outside influence with regards to your prices. So, and this is what punters like. You hear now punters coming up to you, you know, on the race courses, turning around and saying, oh, you're all the same price, you know, this. Yes, we are, unfortunately, all the same price. We're governed by external influences now. We're all the same price. However, punters coming back to the race courses have never had it so good. You know, not be funny, if they saw a burger going from like £2 from £4, they'd be thinking, what great value this is. But now we're 4-1, a 3-1 shot in the old days. But because we're all the same price, punters don't think, oh, what great value this is. So coming back to the trotting and the points-to-points and the dog racing, although unfortunately dog racing, you know, is a dying trade, as we all know, which is such a shame. But the trotting is still, you know, quite buoyant throughout Wales and the UK. It's still, it's got its own niche. It's not everyone's, it's Marmite, it's not everyone's cup of tea. But again, you can go from one end of the ring to the other. There might be 10 bookmakers, Appleby, there might be 20 bookmakers. You're going to be a variance of prices. You know, punters are not quite sure if they can get all the money on. In general, they can, to be quite honest with you. But it's a case of, right, he's 4-1, he's 5-1, what price is up there? Oh, you just missed the 6-1, there's only 4-1 down here, etc., etc. Not quite sure what price they're going to get before they get there. And that's all part of the intrigue and the love of going to these, if you like, working man's sort of tracks and courses. And so hence, yeah, I like it, being a journeyman myself. I like the fact that you go there and you never quite know what to expect. More so the race courses, you know what to expect. You know, basically, all your prices are there for you. You know roughly where you stand. You go to these abstract, inverted commas, unusual places, then they're good fun. They're intriguing. You have to have a bit of devilment. You have to be on top of your game. You've got to be aware of all things that are going on. Faces, who's having a bet. You know, the horses, what mark they're off. And the trotting I love because you've got the draw. You've got tight tracks. You've got different tracks. You've got different ground. You've got hard tracks. You've got a lot of anomalies. Okay, there's not a massive amount of horses. I would probably say maybe 200-400 horses that do the circuit. However, there's a lot from a bookmaking point of view to take in to price up and what to stand and what not to stand. Obviously, we all make mistakes. We make mistakes all the time. Of course, we do. That's life. But you try and obviously cut those down. And trotting, especially, I find for me personally is my most favourite sort of laying. How should I put it? My laying experience, really.
So how do you even start up pricing up a race like that? A trotting heat.
Well, of course, it's like with technology now, everything's totally different. In the old days, you would just go on what you'd see, you'd make notes, you'd have an old program from or a program from each place you went to. You a bit like the old dogs. I remember Dad, he had you know, file of faxes of every time he'd come in of an evening, he'd write down every dog, write down the price, the trap, wide, throughout, whatever, he'd make his own notes. Because obviously on the flapping tracks, there wouldn't be a pink, a greyhound pink, or a racing pink in the old Sporting Life. You know, so that you wouldn't have that access, whereas now you can go online, even with trotting, you go onto the bhrc.org website and you can go and look through all the results for the last probably 20 years. So you've got that at your fingertips. Whereas the old days, it was more so you would price up off. I think even more so in the old days, you would price up off the punter. Whether if it's a big punter, if the big punter, a big gambling stable, you would obviously shorten the price up. You know, I wouldn't tell them that at the time, but if it's a 2-1 shot, you'd probably open up evens 5-4. Knowing full, they'd probably have quite a lot of money on. Albeit it might be a 2-1, 5-2, 3-1 shot in your own mind, or in your own notes, or in your own tissue. So I think, coming back to your question, Simon, it's more so looking at the card, seeing the draw. If it's drawn wide on the outside, you've seen how they're running a 400 metre Olympic, you know, the staggered, whereby at trotting, number four, they're not staggered. So number one draw means that, you know, it's a great advantage to number four or five draw on the outside of the gate. And the gate is the thing that pulls away from the horses when they're lining up. That's you, basically your starter for 10, no conferring.
So those betting rings must be shark infested waters. I mean, you know, how do you survive in them?
Well, I mean, the thing is, the odds dictate. Okay, people will come and say, oh, look at the amazing percentages you're betting to. You're not really. Percentages can be a little bit of a myth, unless you're putting them all in the book. Unless you're laying every horse at, you know, the 10-1 shots, which are sort of 9 or 10% of your book. You might have 4 or 5 of those, and you might only take a couple of quid on them. So the percentage, even though nowadays, of course, with computers, you can see exactly what your percentage is with all the new software. It tells you what percentage you're betting to. The old days, book and ticket especially, you'd have to work it out in your head, you know, 10-1.9%, you know, 5-1 shot, 16%, and you'd add it all up and say, okay, I'm betting to 150, 160 here. I can chug this one a little bit, pull this one in, or push that price out, you know, to try and to gauge a balanced book where possible. Although when we talk about balanced books, me personally, I've always generally got the favourite or one I don't fancy as a loser. I'm not sort of like one to try and bet over, or in this day and age, green up. So it's taking an opinion on the draw, the driver makes a difference, the distance, obviously. They generally run over a mile on the trotting, mile and a quarter some of the races, but generally a mile. You know, what it's up against, whether it's looking to for a handicap mark, you know, there's all sorts of things you need to assimilate. You know, faces, when somebody comes in with a bet early on, you know, only has a tenner on, you're thinking, aye, you know, they know something, good judge. So you then adjust your prices accordingly. You know, so the points are the same within reason, but I do think now technology is a great leveler when it comes down to pricing, to be quite honest with you, solely because there's a lot more information. Even with the trotting, you can go on to Facebook Live, you can go on to you know, S4C were a great advocate 4 or 5 years ago. They would show a lot of races from a place where I love standing at Tier Prince at Towyn in North Wales. They have some great meetings up there. This year there's 8 Saturday nights, but really competitive, really brilliant racing, to be quite honest with you. For anyone who hasn't been trotting, I do suggest that on the trotting side, Tier Prince, Musselburgh on the race course itself is very good. All the Irish horses come over. Appleby is a must, really, for a small, quaint grass track in the middle of Cumbria. You know, and there's a number of local tracks that, you know, for a day out, it's very good fun.
So are there any other unusual types of events that you bet at?
Well, I was called to go over a few years ago with a couple of my Irish punters. Said, look, how do you fancy coming over to Skibbereen, which is in the deepest south of Ireland, and they have the All of Ireland road race there, which is basically no sulky. It's just side saddle running up and down a cobbled street, so that was good fun. Massive crowds again. And don't ask me to price up that. I had to then be a bit crafty and open up late, wait for the other boys to open up, not to pull the prices too much, go along with the flow, not to upset the natives, shall we say. And that was thoroughly enjoyable. So yeah, I've done a bit of a road trotting betting. I think I was under the name of Seamus O'Flynn.
So what's the most, apart from that of course, what's the most bizarre occurrence at an orthodox meeting that you've had?
One of the trotting meetings when I was repping for my dad, betting under shoot. I mean, there's lots of stories I can tell. This is one I do recollect. Now, the flapping, you've got the trotting under the BHRC, and then you've got the flapping under the Wales and West. Again, regulated, but they call it flapping opposed to, you know, the normal harness. And we used to go to some lovely shows, the wife and I, take a picnic, open up the boot, You know, half a bottle of wine while you're sort of betting. I don't recommend that, actually, drinking while you're laying them, but that was the case in those. Quite a relaxed atmosphere. But this one day, I remember that there was probably something like 18 races, just ridiculous, with between 4 and 6 horses a race, going off every sort of 10 minutes, so they didn't mess around. And I was having a bad day. And I said to the wife and dad, I said, this can't get anywhere, surely. Anyway, 4-horse race, 2-1 into 1-2. And they lumped on it, absolutely, all the faces lumped on it. And you know your fate, generally. When that happens, you know your fate. Anyway, it was a 1.25 mile race. And of course, what gets to the front? Straight away, the favourite. And they're going around about 10 laps, like the Queen and a Corgis, basically. They're going around 10 laps, and they're coming around the last lap, you're thinking, right, how much does this cost me? Oh, hold on, love, I'll just add up this column, you know, such a long column, I'm not added up yet. And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to cost me a right few bob. Anyway, they come down the bottom of the hill, turn in the left-hand bend towards the finish, and for some reason, the favourite, which is in front, just carried on going, and the other three behind, all the drivers are looking at each other thinking, what do we do now, guys? What do we do now? And as it happened, it got a puncture and it couldn't control it. So we got out of jail there. So that was quite a funny occurrence. But there's lots of stories like that.
Sorry, Barry, I know people at home are screaming. You can't leave it there. Give us another story.
Well, I do have plenty of stories, actually, but one I can bring to mind now was probably about 10 years ago, Musselburgh Trot. One of the biggest trots of the year. All the Irish are over, you know, great meeting, 14 races of real competitive fare, basically. Anyway, the biggest race of the day came up. It was the Musselburgh free-for-all. Always everybody wants to win this. Always a good betting race. Now, there's a horse come over, well, there was 3 or 4 Irish horses in the race. Good betting race. Anyway, so I'm standing there, I've taken around about 3,500, even money shot. I've stood that for probably about 1,500 quid, thinking, well, I'm gonna get a few more in this race. Anyway, so I priced up on the board. A good Irish punter comes up to me. Don't see him too often, but when you do, you think, you know the time of day. So he sidles up to me, Penol, yeah. You got 8 to on me horse, what's the best price? Well, to be honest with you, you know, that's probably round about right, 8-1. Come on, give us tens. I said, well, how much are you having on? He said, I'm having a grand, that's it. So I'm thinking, bloody hell, you want me to lay you 10,000 for one? I know the horse, good horse, didn't think it would quite suit the track, a horse called Portstown Jack. And I'm thinking, right, okay, well, it's a good betting race, I've got an even money shot in the race, I've got a 6-4, got a 5-2, I'm betting quite well. I said, well, how much are you having on? Pinot, that's all I'm having, I'm just having this grand. Right, I said, okay, I'll do it for you. You can have a 10,000 for one. So as soon as he gets his money out of his pocket like this, the next minute, it's like a Mexican wave all the way down the line. Bang, 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 bang. All the rest of his cronies have dived in on most of the other bookmakers all down the line. And I'm looking down. I actually had a foreman working for me then. Oh, come on, get me 10-1, the 2 horse, you know, the 1 horse, the 2 horse. Anyway, all gone, all down the line. Managed to get a couple hundred quid on for me, to be fair. I stood the horse, so of course I'm fuming, absolutely fuming. You know, he's walked away, the owner's walked away. I'm absolutely fuming, thinking I've been stitched up here. Still got a good chance, it's a cracking free-for-all. So anyway, lo and behold, I've got it for 4,500 quid, which is like, my maximum normally be about £1,500. If I have to stand one, I will. And I was winning on the day, so I was winning a few bob. So I could afford it, still maybe put me behind on the day, but I could afford to stand in. This is how you think as a bookmaker. So, of course, I've got it for 4,500. Couldn't get out of it. It collapses. It actually returns 4-1. So I could have taken under the odds, but I'm not one for that either. If I've laid one at a price, very, very, very rarely will I take one under the odds. I'll stomach it. So, of course, I'm watching this horse in 5th, in 4th. There's 4 in line coming to the furlong post, and this horse is about two lengths behind. Absolutely coming like mad. I'm watching it, I'm thinking, I know what's going to happen here. The part of the Red Sea in front of it, it gets its nose right on the line, short head. There's 4 of them, the one drops away, there's 4 of them across the line, and this Portadown Jack, right bang, width of the cap, right on the line. 4,500 worse off. And I've never seen anybody with so many pockets bulging. He looked like the Michelin Man as he walked off. But it was a fair play to him. Good gambler, but a nice coup. But he was naughty because this is how you trust people. And he let me down saying that was the only £1,000 he was having on. It was all down the line.
Well, Barry, you must be like you are a dyed-in-the-wool professional bookmaker. What's the best and worst thing about your life as, in inverted commas, a journeyman bookie?
Well, I think a journeyman bookie, the best thing is you get to travel quite a lot. Okay, all right, as you get older, you don't quite like you travelling here today to Ludlow. It's taking you about 5 hours, isn't it, from Taunton. So that can happen. You know, you do sort of get sick of the sight of being behind a tractor and, you know, lorries doing about 30 miles an hour at times. However, I think the best times of me bookmaking was definitely booking tickets, without doubt, because I think with booking tickets, you had an affinity with the punters. You would basically initially give out a ticket. You would then say, oh yeah, what's your name? If they come back two or three times, get to know them, say, oh, you don't need a ticket, Gerald or Jimmy or Ginger, or, you know, you don't need a ticket. You'd have that affiliation with people. You'd have that trust between you and the punter. Okay, there's a case that you in the old days, you'd have a few more people leave you on. That stands to reason. It shouldn't happen, but it does, because you basically down a red, yeah, pay me later on, and you wouldn't see them, you know, for a couple of years, and then they'd ignore you. So from that point of view, that wasn't great. But you would have an association with your punter, and the punter would trust you as well. You haven't given them a ticket, the punter would trust you. Whereas now everything's a lot more regulated. Now everything's a lot more on the race courses. It's regimental. It's all a bit mechanical. So I don't like that about the betting these days, I must admit. So, and if you got a good clerk and a good head in the old days booking tickets, you would be a step ahead of the chap next to you. I'd like to think I was, especially on a busy day. If you got a good clerk who can really write 100 miles an hour. So from that point of view, I would like to go back to those days. But travelling up and down the length of the country, I got to Scotland. I put the golf clubs in. Brilliant. I love that. Go down to Devon. I see all my relatives. You know, I can incorporate that as well. So I think also being your own boss, you can't beat. Not answerable to anyone, well, obviously sometimes apart from the missus, but not answerable from anyone to anyone. If you make any ricks, if you do any mistakes, it's down to yourself. And that's one thing I work on my own. I do find that working on my own, I struggle a little bit at times when I'm busy. However, I'm quite happy to crack on. I can do 1,000 tickets a day. I don't particularly enjoy having a clerk, it sounds stupid that, to help me out, because I'd like to do the book myself. And I also think being on the front makes a big difference as well, because people can recognise you. Now, with all due respect to quite a lot of the other bookmakers, they'll put somebody who they'll use every now and then occasionally, and punters don't recognise, or they don't have that bond. Whereas with me being on the front, I have that bond, I like to think anyway, with quite a lot of punters who come up and they can recognise me, you know, whether it be the Tash or whatever. They recognise me and they like to have a bet with me, because in this day and age we're all generally the same prices. So you need to have something different whereby the punter can either know you, say hello, three bags full to you, and they can think, yeah, they're all the same prices, I'll bet with Pino or I'll bet with Barry or whatever. So from that point of view, being on the front of the joint makes a big difference. And also, obviously, I do the computer from the front as well.
So it sounds like quite an idyllic existence to everybody, but I don't think it's a secret you had a health scare not so long ago. Should bookmaking also have a health as well as wealth warning?
Yeah, well, to be quite honest with you, yes. But I mean, they say it's a stressful business. Now, 5 years ago, well, actually, it probably comes back to a little bit earlier than that. 7 years ago, I lost my dad. Now, my dad was a big part of my life, from bookmaking, obviously, right the way through. I lost my mum at 39, and I lost my dad 7 years ago through, unfortunately, CJD, which is a version of Mad Cows. So 3 months earlier I was playing golf with him, unfortunately then he passed away three months later. Coincidentally, I was actually at Foss Lass, training at Foss Lass that day. I'd not been anywhere for 2 weeks because I was in the hospice. I then get a phone call at Foss Lass, and I think Jane Hazel probably vouched for this. I burst into tears, you know, I'm not sorry to say, because I was most upset when I got the call to say my father had passed away. And that was a, if you like, quite a big shock. That was a big shock. The shock was my dad having CJD and knowing, basically looking into it, that he didn't know he had it. Unfortunately, it was a big progressive disease which sort of took him downhill really quickly. And then reading into it, I knew then that there was no hope or no cure, really. So that was a big shock to me. And then 2 years after that, now whether this was connected with my dad obviously passing away, I was told they had leukemia. So I was told 5 years ago I've got leukemia, which is chronic leukemia. At the time, that was a big shock to me, obviously, being told you've got cancer and leukemia, which I didn't know too much about, looked into it, and they said, well, you've got cancer, but it looks like you've got a good type of cancer. Okay, if you can have a good type of cancer, then I'm lucky, I've got leukemia, and I'm on a watch and wait, which is unusual. I don't get any treatment. Mine's an indolent, a sort of lazy type of cancer. So at some stage, unfortunately, it will kick in, but luckily, at the moment, it's a slow burner. I keep having checkups once a year, and I'm very happy with my progress. So I'm lucky on that front. I can still go about my everyday business. However, 2 years after that, I then had a very, very minor heart attack. They called me in, did me all the check over, and I had an angiogram, checked the heart, and I had 3 blocked arteries. So hence, they then said, I'm going to have to go in for a triple heart bypass. So about 3 weeks later, I went in. Actually, they had a sale on, and they did 4. I had a quadruple. They had a bog-off offer. The best bog-off offer I've probably ever had. So I had a quadruple bypass, and luckily enough, touch wood, I've been okay ever since. Obviously, I watch my eating and my food and everything else, cholesterol, try and keep all that down. So the old the pies at the race courses and the chip butties on the way home have gone out the window. But I try and look after myself as well as I can. On coming down to the original question, the stress, yes, okay, you've got stress on the stool, you stand a favourite, and it's 20 clear, going to the last, you know, that obviously probably raises your blood pressure. Driving, that's a sense of pressure. Everyday life, maybe. Although I'm not a stressful person, or I don't think I am, obviously that could possibly, affect your health and your standard of living and everything else, really.
So you've not put that down to bookmaking, but what is the biggest problem that faces people like yourself, independent on-course bookmakers at the moment?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it's widely known, isn't it? It's widely published about apps, computers, exchanges. I mean, but when exchanges came along, you know, that was half a death knell for traditional inverted commas bookmakers like myself. But obviously, then helped bookmakers coming along, or your mice who are now turned into lions who can take big bets if you like. I've most of it away on exchanges. Green up, make a little profit for 20, 50, 100 quid or whatever they green up for, and they're quite happy with that. Whereby, the old days, you'd go out and maybe do a couple of grand, but the next day, you know, you've got a good chance of winning 3 grand. And they were the swings. Whereas now, because the margins are so tight, it's a lot more favourable for the punter, you know, and they've never had this good, to be quite honest with you. This is why it's so surprising that take on course has dropped reasonably dramatically over the last couple of years, even though the punter's far better off. No commission, no premium charge, etc., etc. We all know the arguments for that. So I think from my point of view, computers, okay, it makes things a lot easier. Issuing a ticket, a printed ticket, which I think is good for the punter because they can see exactly, you know, what they've had opposed to the old ticket, which just had 3 numbers on. And also the bookmaker can tell exactly where they are in the book. They know exactly which price to push out. If it flashes because the exchange price is bigger, pull it in. You know, if you like, any Muppet, with all due respect to, you know, race course workers, any Muppet can work a book. Whereas the art's gone to a certain degree. You know, they've got software now that you can just hit a button and it'll say, you can green up now for £20, hit this button, you can green up. You can green up for £15, hit this button. Well, that's simple, isn't it, for some people? And they're happy to make £100 over, you know, on a day. But for traditional bookies, it's a lot harder now. So I don't like computerisation, although I've gone along with it, which we have to, you know. And it's, in some aspects it's okay, other aspects it's bad news for certain bookmakers. And of course, I don't like multi-operators. Now, I run 2 pitches at Cheltenham last week. I had 2 intact. But I don't agree with multi-operating in one ring. The old days, you'd have maybe 8, 10, 12 bookmakers turn up in a ring. Now you've probably got 20. But those 20 might only be 4 or 5 operators. Fast last, I think they've only got 8 operators. But there might be 30 bookmakers turn up one day. And they've got 3, 4, 5 pitches, which, you know, to me, it's not right. Okay, different rings. If you want 1 on the rails, 1 in the silver ring, and 1 in tats, okay, fine. That's all right. I don't have a problem with that. But for bookmakers to think, right, we need to run 3 pitches now because business isn't as great, so we'll have 3 into 1. You've got more expenses. The race courses are quite happy. They're getting their money from it. You know, we're, to a certain degree, we're sort of mules for the race courses, really. You know, Cheltenham last week, £5,000 expenses for 2 pitches. You know, it's ridiculous. Probably 10 years ago, those expenses would have been probably £1,500. So the race courses have cottoned onto this. There's no quarter given there. you know, your turnover's gone down so much that these people feel like they need to have three or four pitches. But then, me being a single operator, obviously, if there's three pitches all in one name and there's me there, you know, I'm being watered down by, well, not quite three quarters, but at least a half, because there'd be one pitch and me, but now there's three and one. So from my point of view, as a single independent operator, and it's probably the same with the shops and whatever, you know, of course, the Gambling Commission have come in, and they're charging an arm and a leg. Independents are being priced out of the market. And it's a little bit the same with on-course bookmakers. And that's why you don't see too many young lads coming through. Because A, your equipment's probably going to be 10, 15 grand to buy to set up to start off with. And then when you get on-course, the margins are not there. Obviously better for the punter, but the margins aren't there to, you know, to earn a good few bob unless you're sort of crafty and streetwise. Because you're playing against people, experienced people who have been left in the game now on course, who know the time of day. So from that point of view, I don't like that. I don't like that at all. And for future, I think the future will still be all right. People still like going to the race courses and bringing out, you know, cash. Although, albeit they probably don't go to the race courses with as much cash as they used to, you know. And a lot of the boys, I know there's a few that take credit cards or debit cards, but not too many because we all deal with cash. We're a cash society, and as we all know, people don't carry as much cash around now. So that's also a downside. But I still believe that people, punters especially, love going to the race courses. They might draw X amount out of the bank and think, right, okay, and there's no better feeling for a punter to go up to a bookie, even though we might have a face like a smacked ass, going up to a bookie and collecting money off him, you know, and thinking, oh, thanks, Mr. Bookie, that's very nice of you, more so than the credit card and not seeing that cash. You know, so from that point of view, I do think, bookmaking, and also obviously with the trotting and the point-to-points and the dogs, and not so much the dogs, but the trotting and the point-to-point where there's no exterior influence, should we say, from internet betting, prices and everything else, I still think they'll be reasonably strong. I think, you know, that's a joy. The punters and race-goer and owners and trainers alike still like going to these sort of venues because they're not quite sure what price they're going to get on the horse. They're not quite sure how much they'll get on, you know, and they've got the variety, which is always quite nice, really, opposed to the, you know, rigidity of the race course, you know, on-course market as it is.
So looking back over your career, Barry, would you have changed anything?
I think when buying and selling came in, I think I'd have probably, instead of being labelled as a journeyman like I am now, I think I'd have probably preferred to have bought better pitches initially with my money, opposed to buying a lot of pitches. I think it might have been more prudent because they've seemed to have, the better pitches have held them the market value, and obviously, in theory, you make more money out of the better pitches because you're in prime positions, you know, whereby the poorer pitches, now money doesn't flood through to the back line from the front line bookies because all they're doing is having it on the exchanges, having it away, it goes away from the track, opposed to filtering back through the lines, which was the case when I first bought pitches before the exchanges. Then I think from that point of view, that's not all going well, but in general, we get on with things.
So in a sentence, somebody sat watching this, enough money to buy their kit, fancy being a bookie, what would you say?
Well, I think, I'm always on the positive side, but I'm afraid I can't really see how you're really going to make it pay. So, yes, have a go, dip your toe in the ring, maybe, you know, through the summer, not a problem, but if you're trying to do a 365 year occurrence and make money at it, you can't really. The winter's so hard nowadays. The expenses sort of kill you, really. You know, they've gone through the roof with marketing fees and everything else, which that's another question altogether. You know, it's very, very hard. You've got to take into account your expenses and everything else.
Thank you very much, Barry.
It's not just online betting at Star Sports. You can call us too on 08000 5-1 3-1 and speak directly to one of our friendly and experienced traders. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.